Welcome on to our continuing season previews. This is going to be the Denver Nuggets, and joining us is Matt Moore from CBS Sports and the creator of Hardwood Paroxysm, which is quite relevant today since they just came out with their own written season preview. Matt, what's up?
Hey, man. I'm really excited to be on this podcast. Everyone speaks so highly of it, so I'm hoping this will raise my respect level across media, the internet, and the league.
Well, I'm hoping it'll raise my respect level to have you on. So we were talking just before we started that this Nuggets team, and the reason I had you on, obviously, for those who don't know, is that Matt's based out of Denver. He does national work, but goes to most of the Nuggets games and is pretty plugged in there. It's looking, based on the preseason, that this team might actually be a pretty fun one to cover this year.
Yeah, and that's kind of the, you know, expectations are the devil of preseason. It's such a problem because, you know, putting unrealistic expectations on, you want to set a bar and try and reach hard, but the big thing is that management has handled it well, coaching has handled it well in terms of saying, we don't want to get to the playoffs, we don't want to get to 500, we're not looking for 40 wins or 50 wins, we just want to get better. And that's how really every team that's not a championship contender should approach it, is we just want to be better. And meanwhile, from a coverage aspect, last year was so miserable to where, like, I always love going to games. Like, every single time I step into an arena with a media pass, it's a special experience. I'm just like, this job rules. Like, this is so great. And there were times last year where I was like, I don't want to go. Are you kidding me? I don't want to deal with it. Because everyone in the locker room was so unhappy and trying to get out of there so quickly. They were getting blown out to disgusting degrees. Like, just abhorrent losses. I mean, they lost to teams that were on a back-to-back in Denver, and that's like a cardinal sin. You cannot lose to teams that are on a back-to-back in Denver because they're always so worn out and the altitude hits them. And they lost consistently. So I'm really looking forward to the fact that this team is just going to be a more pleasant experience to be around this year.
Yeah, and those Brian Shaw interviews were just so awkward, too, where he would just be killing his players in the media, or like, you know, more of just this kind of old school tough guy stuff that you just cringe to hear because you know it's not working and he's probably saying the same stuff to his players and it's just falling on deaf ears.
Yeah, and it started early, actually, where it became a running joke within the first 2 months of the season that I kept making the joke that if Kenneth Faried went out and scored and broke the scoring record set by Wilt Chamberlain and held up the 101 sign, that Brian Shaw's reaction would be to criticize his penmanship. Like, it was just really, because Faried would go out, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of problems with Faried, but Faried would go out and have a 15-point, 20-rebound game, 20 points, 15-rebound game, and those are encouraging things, and you can build off of that to help get his defense better, to keep him engaged, and instead Shaw would just tear him down and say, well, he didn't do this well, I thought that his defense could have been better, like, it's fine. And it did. It was awkward at times, and it just, he so quickly lost the locker room. And it was really surprising to all of us because, you know, it was, well, Brian Shaw just doesn't get this generation. And my response to that was always, George Karl, who's like 20 years older than Shaw, connected with them and got them to win. So how is it that this guy failed so miserably? It's interesting, though. The interview that was interesting, most of the people did not like Shaw for the quotes that he gave, but mostly because he wasn't, like, affable and wasn't really funny and it wasn't really intense. I liked it. He would talk about – Shaw is still – he's a smart basketball dude, and I think that there's a chance that down the line he could have success with another team if he gets another opportunity. And I also think that Brian Shaw is a really good man. I really do believe that. I feel like he's a character guy. He just walked into the wrong situation, and he was prepared for it to be – something different, more like what he'd experienced in LA and Indiana, and the character group was so vastly different that he was wildly unprepared for how much of a challenge that was for him.
Yeah, it's funny because coming in, he had kind of a reputation as really being a good guy, someone that you might have thought would be someone who could connect with the players, but I think also the fact that he came into a situation where they'd experienced a lot of success, that they'd won 57 games the year before he got there. Granted, then they had the defection of Iguodala to Golden State, but you would have thought that he could have been a lot more successful in relating to everyone than he was.
Yeah, being a former player too, you would just think, and I mean, it has been interesting to note that, you know, Brian Shaw obviously gave the, wow, like, it's a different league than it was when I came into the league. But also, like,
yeah, just look at his suits.
Right. But also, like, players would, some of the players would say the same thing, where they would say, these young guys, that was actually what everyone blamed it on that first year. In 2014, that's what everyone blamed it on, was they said that the young guys were disruptive and they didn't get the work ethic and all these things. And then in 2015, it really just became apparent that no one believed in Shaw. His assistant coaches were, he had some good ones, particularly those left over from Carl. Like Patrick Mutombo, who's now with the Spurs, was really good. They had some good coaches. Their training staff's really good. But they also, he brought in some dudes that weren't just bad. They were downright borderline unprofessional. And that was a really big problem. So when everyone looks at kind of the head coaching situation, they forget that it's a staff. And that was a big problem too. But also, like, he always kind of expected guys to just fix things by, well, you just fix them. You know, we asked him about their big problems were shooting and fouling. Those were the two things that they were really bad at. If you're really bad at those two things, it's hard to win a basketball game. And it would be like, well, what can you do to kind of fix the problem that your team can't shoot? And he would just be like, we got to make shots. And it's like, well, okay, but you have to find better ways to put those guys in a position. And there wasn't really that kind of approach to it. And then, you know, foul rate, it was, guys just got to be more disciplined. And it's like, well, no, like you need to adjust what you're doing. There was chaos in terms of their pick and roll strategies, where every time I would ask about it, they would say they were doing something different, to the point where they said, we're mixing and matching a lot of things. And I finally asked one Nuggets player off the record. I was like, do you guys know what you're doing on pick and rolls? He's like, nope, no clue. Trying to figure it out play by play. No one has any idea. And that's a real problem when you don't have a floor general on the court most of the time, unless Darrell Arthur's in. So it was a mess. It was a total mess.
In fairness to Scott, they probably were missing their best player throughout probably his entire tenure in Gallinari.
It's funny that you said Brian. You said Scott in terms of it's very easy to confuse Byron Scott and Brian Shaw.
Did I say Scott?
Very easy to confuse the two, right? Former Lakers, old school mentality.
BS initials.
BS initials.
Yeah, well, and I had Darius Soriano on for the Lakers podcast last night too, which I recorded like 12 hours ago. So that's probably right. Another reason.
So the Gallo thing is interesting in that, yeah, he was out all of 2014. So that was obviously a problem. And then 2015, he had another meniscus injury that I really was like, well, that's it for him. And then he came back and had a phenomenal close to the year. He really played well. The issue, I think, is you and I are both metrics guys, right? Like, you're Rough Nylon Calculus. Like, we're both very metrics-oriented. It doesn't take being around a team very long to understand the value of chemistry and of how the locker room is reacting. For me, there are several points in which I was like, they got to fire him now. The biggest one was, I believe it was the MLK Day game. They played on a Monday in Golden State.
Yeah, I was there for that game. That was a disaster.
And the Warriors were up at one point by 50 plus. And I said the next week, I said to everybody, I said in the media room, I said, like, I was not going to hype from this. I was like, that's the worst performance I think I've ever seen by a basketball team. Because, like, the Charlotte Bobcats in 2009 or whenever, when they were setting the record for least wins, like the lowest winning percentage.
The lockout year, 2011.
That team was trying. They just sucked. Like, they were just bad. That was the worst part about this Denver team, is that there's a perception that this Denver team is not talented. This team has a lot of basketball talent, but those guys hated coming to work. I think a lot of them did not like playing with each other. They were all frustrated with the environment, and they hated playing for that coaching staff. And that's why there was a lot of talk in Denver about, you know, how much of it is on Shaw and how much is on players. And I said, look, you got to fire Shaw because this situation is untenable. And you can't do anything but fire Shaw. Like, you have to start over immediately. But I also said the players bear a lot of responsibility for the degree to which they quit being professionals about how they went about their business. And that was really the big change I think that management focused on this summer, was trying to add character, to reevaluate the locker room leadership structure, and to provide a new vibe so that the team will feel differently. And that way maybe the talent will start to look a little bit more like some of the guys that are still there from the 2013 team.
All right, well, so enough about last year. Basically, you can think of Gallo as almost being a new addition since he was really only himself kind of those last 20 games or so. They gave up Ty Lawson, got a protected first-round pick for him, which might be disappointing to a lot of people, but once his alcohol problems really kind of came to the fore, that's as good as they're going to do.
Nick Johnson!
Now, what'd you say?
And they got Nick Johnson!
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he could be a player someday, maybe, although you don't hear the greatest things about his attitude, at least in his previous stops. But now they've got Emmanuel Mudiay, and at least to these eyes, he's looked awesome so far.
So, Mudiay, trying to do draft analysis for a guy in China is tough, right? And you talk to as many scouts as you can. You talk to as many people that know him as you can. And everyone said, no, he's legit. He's crazy good.
And he also had the ankle injury.
And he had the ankle injury. And so,
seven games.
So coming in, I was like, well, he should be pretty good. He's at least got the value to make the pick appropriate. They didn't reach for anybody, which is good. But I didn't really know much about his game or how to assess him. And I was kind of 19-year-old went to China. A lot of question marks here. And summer league in general, I used to be super into summer league and hyperanalyze it. And I've just, because I wear myself out over the course of the year, July, I'm kind of that's my time. I get the first 2 weeks of free agency and then I want to go hiking. So I was very I would have the games on for summer league here at the house and just kind of look up and I would glance up and see him making passes and reads and just my eyebrows would arch and I'd be like, okay, his instincts are just unbelievable. This kid understands passing lanes at his age way better than I had expected. His biggest thing is that when you get under the basket, there are guys that are 25 in the league and still cannot make those reads. They get freaked out by the traffic and you've seen this before. They are always looking to make it to the corner. And if you figure out that he can't make that pass to the inside, teams are always going to cheat to that corner to pick those passes off. He is able to instinctively understand those, and he understands the over-the-shoulder throw to the wing as well. It's crazy how instinctive this guy is. And then you look at it. I noticed in his first preseason game, Chris Paul destroyed him defensively over the first couple of minutes. But in the third quarter, after he started to settle down, Paul came back on the floor and was like, all right, maybe I'll try and cook him a little bit offensively. Paul turned, looked at how big Mudiay is, and was like, nope, I'm not messing with this in preseason. He is so big. He's 6'5", but his shoulders are massive. His frame is just really big, and that's going to help him out a lot defensively because he's so athletic. That's going to cover up for a lot of the knowledge base issues. He's going to be a good defender from the start just from the way that he's built. You throw in the fact that the shot's going down. Now, I think once he hits the rookie wall, it's going to completely fall apart. I think the back half of the year, he's going to shoot something 25% from three. But there's enough with his shot right now, Nate, to where I think that I'm not – from the start, this thing is broken and it's going to take a lot of work for him to ever be a passable shooter. I'm more like, okay, there's something there. And if he can build on that, he could be he could be not a good shooter, but a good enough one to be a good player combined with his great passing skills. There's a lot to love about Mudiay.
You talked about this feel that he has and the vision for making those passes, especially to shooters. And I saw him at the Hoop Summit last year. I don't recall seeing that out of him. Now, that's with a bunch of guys that were just thrown together for the week. There weren't a ton of great shooters among guys who are, U20, who are coming in. But from then until watching his film in China and then seeing him in summer league and in the preseason, makes me think that going to China, while a lot of people say it's kind of a joke and there are a lot of weird aspects to it, and they play at a crazy pace there, and it's odd because you only have two Americans on the team and they're limited in the number of minutes that they can play. All that stuff is true, but they play with NBA rules in a very NBA style, and they play usually with one big man and spread the floor and run pick and roll, and there's a ton of shooters, and he showed the ability, learned there, I think, how to make a lot of those passes in kind of an NBA spread pick and roll style that you wouldn't necessarily have in college. So I thought that he going to China really was good for him, even if it may have kind of hurt him in the pre-draft process, and he ended up falling to 7, but I think ultimately we're going to realize that he should have gone a lot higher.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with him also, when you look at his background and what his mom had to go through and the poverty that they've lived in, not only in the Congo Republic, but also stateside, like they've had a hard time.
Yeah, he came over when he was 10.
Yeah. I can't blame him for making a decision that's going to help his family out financially.
Oh yeah, of course not. No, I'm sure we both agree that how ridiculous the NCAA
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and also it's just like you mentioned it. And Larry Brown might have been a little bit different, but generally speaking, like just college teams don't run pick and roll enough, and so these guards come in and they haven't run it, and coaches hate having to teach players how to run pick and roll. Like it's really annoying. And there's still a lot of stuff that he's going to fix. He's coming around too wide right now, and he's still getting a feel for. And also he's with a team that honestly this team sucks at screening. There are two good screeners on the team, and one of them is hurt right now. Although Jokic shows some potential. There's a lot of work on, but he has a natural understanding of the flow of the game. He understands the motion. He understands how the NBA game operates. And that innate understanding and that early understanding of it, I think is going to put him ahead of the pack. And there's a reason why, you know, everyone thinks that he's really high in the Rookie of the Year odds.
Yeah, so and on his jump shot, I worry a little about it too. He really kind of skies on his jumper, shoots a little bit
so much
on the way down.
His legs are all over the place.
Yeah, and you know he shot 34% when he was in China. He's been shooting well in the preseason. Did not shoot as well, but you know is at least willing to take him in summer league. But I think when you look at a guy, it's not only his makes, but when his misses are really bad, my feeling is that then you can kind of project that maybe it's not real unless he starts really doing it over a large sample size.
Yeah, you know, I think I will say a lot of the things I like about him, you know, the basketball stuff is easy to recognize. Like, oh, wow, he's the size of a house. Like, you know, he's basically this giant jaguar just chasing down balls on the court.
Yeah, and he's a real point guard, too. Like, he's got a point guard handle, you know, no defensiveness to his dribble when he's in transition, like a lot of 6'5 guys. Like, he is a point guard.
Yeah.
No question.
But one of the things, his attitude right away has really shined, and not just in the media stuff, but also I took real note of it in that preseason game. After CP3 just ruined his world and introduced him to the NBA and just tore him apart. I mean, it was really brutal what Chris did to him, which is why I loved it after the game when Paul went up to him and like talked to him for solid 2 minutes and gave him advice and then gave him a hug and sent him on his way. I was like, that's just a great, like, that's awesome. That's like everything cool about the league right there. But I really wanted to see. I was like, okay, because it got to the point where Randy Foy took over the point guard duties in that starting lineup, like before they pulled Moutier out. Like, Foy, you know, he started to inbound after a made basket, and Foy grabbed it, and Moutier held up his hands, and Foy's like, no, like, you tried. It's okay. We're going to go do something else for a while because there's veterans, and we don't want to get embarrassed right now. And so I wanted to see how he did when he came back in. And he came back in, and he settled down, and he went right back at them. And then he's done this in the preseason where you mentioned his willingness to take those threes. He's basically saying, if you're not going to I'm going to make you respect my jumper. And if you do not respect it, I'm going to burn you with it. And just that willingness is a big thing because a lot of those point guards would bottle up and really get afraid and be tentative. And instead, he has maintained his level of aggressiveness. And that to me shines, you know, very well on what he's going to be capable of in the league.
Yeah, and he was getting his butt kicked by Curry early on Tuesday. And then he actually really improved and came back to have a really nice game. And, you know, let's not go crazy on him. I mean, I think he is a very good candidate to shoot under 40% this year because he especially – he's got a lot of fakes, but if there's a big man there, he is not quite have the ability yet to finish his in-between game. I mean, he's been taking a lot of kind of tough fadeaways that have been kind of no-chancers. But, all right, let's move on for Moutier here. You know, I guess they're bringing a lot of guys back. But one of the big new additions is the coach, Mike Malone. There was a little bit of eyebrow raising because ostensibly the whole reason that Sacramento moved on from him was he wasn't playing fast enough. Denver is a place where they always have liked to play faster, but Malone has said maybe that he's going to try and pick up the pace from when he was in Sacramento.
I have a theory, and this is not confirmed by Michael Malone, so this is a theory. This is, you know, speculative. Based off of the conversations I've had with people, this is honestly what I believe happened. Michael Malone, his dad is a coach. His dad's an assistant coach in the league. He's a coach's kid. He's been in this league a long time. He's got the same kind of traditional concepts. And so for him, it starts with defense. And in the playoffs, you need to be able to slow it down and win the half-court game. And so he's had skepticism about whether or not you can win playing fast. And I think that it's easy to paint that as backwards, but instead it's also very easy to understand that kind of concept. I think that as early as recently as like last February, I think he had real questions about whether or not you can win playing at breakneck speed. I think the Warriors changed his mind. I think he saw what the Warriors did playing at.
What are you basing that on?
I'm basing that off of questions I've asked him and conversations I've had with people that are, quote, close to the situation. I asked him about it first off in media day, okay?
Yeah.
So I heard kind of things about it, and I said, you know, look, as far as pace goes, the Warriors are the number one team in defensive efficiency, and they were the number one team in pace. And I asked him, I was like, do you think that signals a change? And he said, you know, I think that a lot of coaches looked at the Warriors and realized that if you get stops and run off of them, that it is possible. If you really are willing to commit yourself the way the Warriors are, that you can combine those two things. We'll have to see. Now, I think it'll be very easy if they struggle for him to say, this isn't working, we have to go back to slowing it down. I think that's very easy for him to go to. I do think, though, that the Warriors represented, to a degree, kind of proof of how you can combine a tough defense-first approach with speed and picking up the pace.
And, yeah, it's interesting. He, I think, said in some interviews over the summer that, yeah, you know, we've played slow because we have the best post-up center in the league.
Right.
You know, that's a pretty good reason to play slow. And I also think, you know, he started in that game against Golden State. Maybe that was a one-off just because of who they are playing and they don't really have a post-up threat. But he started a front court of Chandler, Gallo, and Fareed and switched everything 1 through 4. And it was really effective against a Golden State team, which, you know, admittedly probably wasn't trying that hard and is missing their coach. But it looked pretty good.
They're going to switch everything. That is good. Like, that is the one thing that...
And Moutier allows them to do that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the one thing that I've really picked up on is the defensive strategy is we're going to switch everything. I think a lot of that comes down to it may change when Nurkic gets back. That may be a situation where in pick-and-roll coverage they drop Nurkic. But he really – and a lot of people kind of recognize this. There's so much potential with Kenneth Faried defensively that he has not unlocked. And that's been on him to a large degree. But I think that, especially with the way Draymond got recognition last year, I think Kenneth Faried kind of believes that he's as good or can be better than Draymond Green, at least defensively. But he has to commit himself to it. And so I think – that's not true, by the way, but I think he believes it. I think Malone has a plan to really say, look, Faried's hyper-athletic, super aggressive, and he's tough as nails. So why don't we use him more to blitz the pick and rolls and really get up in guys' faces and say, like, we're going to switch it. You want to go up Faried, go up Faried, and see how it works out. Because Faried's not scared to come up into a guy and really challenge him. But yeah, they're definitely going to switch all of that. I was shocked because I asked on media day, I was like, are we going to see, you know, like where are we at on small ball? And I had kind of thought that he was going to stay pretty traditional. Nope. He's very much like they're going to bend a lot of the stuff in terms of positionality. Chandler and Gallo also allow them to do that a lot because he mentioned very strongly about how well Gallo played at the four, both last year and in Eurobasket. They're going to play a lot of small ball. They're going to put Faried at the five. They're going to play two point guards with Emmanuel Mudiay and Jameer Nelson a lot. Like there's going to be some positional funk with this team. And I think that's going to help them a lot with the kind of players that they have.
And they have some players who can switch pretty well too. You talked about Faried. Nurkic actually has much quicker feet than people give him credit for. And I think he's someone who at least, you know, you don't want him switching at the start of a possession, but at least late clock, he can keep guys in front of him pretty well, assuming he's recovered from that partially torn patella. Darrell Arthur, who's always been a real good defender, you mentioned earlier, he's been another one of those guys who can really move his feet defensively against guys on the perimeter, even to the point where he was playing the three at times in some really bad Shaw lineups, but, you know, he can hold up there defensively. And I also think at center, Fareed goes from kind of a minus shooter as a power forward to a guy who can drag the Andrew Bogut types out at least to 20 feet or so. I think he was effective doing that against Bogut on Tuesday. So, you know, I think that this could be another great team for the small ball revolution. But then, and then also, Nurkic is a guy who can post up really hard if he's got, you know, if they're not playing with Fareed at power forward, if they're going with Chandler and Gallo, then he can get a lot, make a lot of hay, you know, posting up right under the basket and forcing help.
Yeah, and Nurkic is more nimble and faster than I really gave him credit for early. He's surprisingly, like, and he's also got pretty good motor that gets better every time. Now we'll see how that. We'll see what kind of condition he is when he gets back from the injury. That's a real big concern. Is
yeah, he was huffing and puffing in kind of some pretty standard drills that don't usually make NBA players tired when I saw him on Tuesday. So I think he's got a ways to go.
It's going
to
be a while. You know, and you mentioned the jumper. I wrote a piece on Fareed, and I talked to Malone about, you know, because my belief is, like, don't worry about Fareed's offensive game. Like, just basically tell him, run, get dunks, play defense, and you can still be a star in this league. Like, if you do, if you play really great defense, you can be a star in this league, even if you don't necessarily have a great post-up game. That jumper the other night, look, if he's got it, if he's improved and he can knock down that 18-footer consistently, that's going to dramatically change what Kenneth Fareed is capable of. I'm going to have to see it before I believe in it. And I'm the same way. Like, I don't believe he's going to have a post game. He just, it's always awkward. It's never been good. But I also just think that he's got such raw athleticism that that's going to be a real boon. I think that their ability to switch what they do and change what they do in game based off of what they need is going to be very strong. Nurkic allows them to do that a lot because Nurkic is just a beast. He's just, he's big. He's talented. He's got great touch. There's a lot that they can do there. The Darrell Arthur thing is like my own personal crusade. Chris Dempsey of the Post does not think he's going to play a lot this year. They think that he's mostly going to be like a back of the end three for them. I don't really understand it because their best defensive lineups have always featured Darrell Arthur. Like, he's the only guy on that team that has made their defense better because he's the only one that understands how to communicate. He's the only one that understands, like, what's going on the floor. He's the only one I've talked to that pays attention to defensive metrics for the other team. Like, he's rigorous in the scouting and being prepared. He's got injury issues, but generally speaking, like, I'm a huge proponent of Kenneth Fareed and Darrell Arthur starting together. And if you say you're going to get killed on the boards, I'm like, Kenneth Fareed can rebound, so I'm not necessarily worried.
Wait, do you think that Darrell Arthur should start over Nurkic?
No. I think until Nurkic gets back, Arthur's.
Okay.
Nurkic is too good not to play, and they've invested too much in him. You know, I guess here's the thing. All the numbers with Nurkic are good just because, again, he's just so big. I want to see what happens this year. I guess I'll say that, in that there's a lot to love about Nurkic's game. There's a lot of Nurkic is one of those Eastern European dudes who has no time for your nonsense. So there's some pride there. He's a young guy. He's brash. And so I want to see kind of how that fits and what kind of success that he's able to have with this coaching staff. So there's some questions there. And again, like a lot of what we're talking about in terms of what they can do, there are going to be nights when they're tightly wound in terms of being tight with everything that they're doing, and they're playing with good energy, and they're going to be a lot better than they were last year. Even if it's not necessarily good enough to beat good teams, they'll be competitive. The problem is that if one thing unwinds with this team, the whole thing can fall apart very quickly, and that, I think, is where you get into the problems that they're going to have with the win totals.
Yeah, and if anything happens to Gallo, they're going to suck offensively. I think they're going to run into big problems because they're not really going to have a guy who can stretch the defense, have enough shooting, you know, a guy who can still defend on the other end as well. He to me, just because he's not just amazing at any one thing, I think he's always been kind of underrated, yeah. But just his shooting, especially if they're playing him at the four, having a guy who can create one-on-one with a jump shot, late clock, all that stuff. Without him, I think that they're in big trouble.
They were insane in 2013, in part because people do not realize he's a really good defender. He's very good defensively, and the big key was that when Iguodala was taking the primary perimeter threat, that allowed Gallo to take the secondary threat, And that was really good. And that, you know, that Warrior series would have been helped a lot by him being able to guard Klay Thompson. You know, I think with them, I have, you're right that if Gallo goes down, like, that's it. Like, they'll fall apart. But I think there's a lot of guys that could have kind of bounce back years. One guy in particular that's looked really good in the preseason with his aggressiveness and just looking like he's back into a good place with his game is Wilson Chandler. If Wilson can stay healthy, this is still a guy that's got great – he can be a really good shooter from the perimeter and can score very effectively. He's also strong and athletic, and he looks in great shape. He has been in Denver all summer and has really committed himself to being ready for this season. I think he could actually wind up having a really good year. I've always believed that there's more to Wilson Chandler than what we've seen. And I think that if he can stay healthy, which obviously it's for anybody, but he's also had a lot of injury problems, Wilson's another guy that – could have a really good year. But yeah, you're right. If Gallo's out, then that's pretty much their only guy you can count on for buckets.
Who's going to start at the two for this team?
Gary Harris. It's going to be Gary Harris. I thought it was going to be Gary Harris coming into camp. I thought that serious kind of deal. Like, Harris has a good mentality. He's coachable. Every coach that's run into him, from college to scouting to the draft process to Brian Shaw's staff to now Michael Malone's, they talk about how good he is at his age defensively. And I mean, you know this, if you're able to play well defensively from the get-go, that's going to help you get minutes. He's got great instincts. He's very good defensively. His shot mechanics are one where I looked at, you know, scouting him in college. I was like, God, this guy's form is terrific. And then I saw the same thing in warmups. And then he would miss in games, and everyone's like, well, he's a bust, he can't shoot. And I'm just like, no, like, he's a rookie, he needs to get comfortable. He's shooting better in preseason. I think that's going to continue. Look, Gary Harris is not going to be some sort of superstar. He's not going to be an all-star. But do I think that Gary Harris can be a really great 3-and-D guy? I do. I think that he's going to be I think he'll take a step forward this season. I definitely think he's going to start at the two.
Yeah, obviously he's got a long way to go from last year when he had a 4.9 PER and under 40% true shooting, even while taking half of his shots from three last year. So that's pretty rough. But do you think he has the size to work well in this switching scheme that we've been talking about?
Yeah, because I think part of it is, I think you can play him on point guards, and I think you can play him, you know, there are going to be situations where he'll get outmatched. There have been some times in preseason when he's been posted up, and that's tough for him. He still needs to add, obviously, upper body mass like a lot of rookies do. But I think Moutier helps a lot with this, right, where they can kind of scheme to be able to help. And I just – he's – one, his hands are very active, and he challenges dribble. So even if he gets matched up against a bigger guy, if that bigger guy doesn't have necessarily as good of a handle, Harris can kind of attack it and deter them into maybe getting the ball out of his hands. I think there's a lot that he can do. There are going to be rough stretches, right? Like, he's going to have nights where he gets torched. But there's enough there, I think – to like what he can do. Now, I think we're going to see a lot of we'll see a lot of Jameer Nelson and Moutier playing together. We won't see Chandler at the two, which a lot of us have kind of predicted. That's like off the table. But I think that we will see a lot of Jameer Nelson and Moutier playing together to balance the shooting with Moutier's inability to do so. But I think that Harris will get good opportunities and will have some good nights and kind of show he's an NBA player.
Yeah, Harris is a little bit undersized. He's basically 6'4 in shoes,
right.
205, 6'7 wingspan, so that's maybe about average, perhaps slightly below for a shooting guard. And he does compete. I like his ability to navigate screens. He is a high motor player. So, all right, you're Byron Scott. I mean, Brian Shaw. I mean Michael Malone. What is your crunch time lineup for this team with 5 minutes to go in the game?
Moutier, because you want him to learn those situations. Jameer Nelson. This is where it gets very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, you got to decide between Nurkic, some combination of Nurkic, Fareed, Chandler, and Gallo. Is that where what you're trying to struggle with here?
Don't
do it. Don't say Darrell Arthur. Come on.
Why?
Don't do it.
He's so. Like, have you looked at his defensive numbers? You got to look at his defensive numbers, Nate.
Oh, no. I know he's a good I know he's a good defensive player, but he just can't hit a shot. It's all long twos. He's,
yeah, but if you're at the end,
you know,
yeah,
every year he's going to shoot a three, and he's never he never gets there.
If you're at the end of the game, do you need all five? Let me. I want philosophically at the end of the game, do you need all five guys to be able to hit the shot? Considering how
how
dominant and isolation heavy almost all of that play is.
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. I think the league is moving away from that a little bit, especially the last 5 minutes. I mean, I think certainly as like a defensive sub, you know, when you're doing offense defense at the end, I could see putting him in more.
Yeah,
but I just don't think he's a good enough offensive player, and he's also a guy who, you know, you said that this is a developmental season. It's a season when you're just trying to get better, and you've got Nurkic, Fareed, Gallo, and Chandler are all guys who are either on eight-figure contracts or, you know, the future, and Darrell Arthur is making $3 million bucks or whatever it is, and, you know, angering those guys by putting him in crunch time all the time, I think, and not allowing those guys to kind of evolve and be part of the endgame unit.
Well,
is a little worrisome to me, too.
Well, okay. I mean, the question is, like, do you want to win, or do you want to make people happy? And that was always the problem, like, last year, is, like, everyone was selfish. Like, if this team is going to talk about how much they're committed to everybody and the team's success, I would go with Moutier, Jameer. So here's the problem. Okay, let's put Gallo at three. You need Gallo on the floor no matter what.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes... If you're going to do that, and you're not going to go with Wilson and Gallo at the 3-4, which I don't think you do.
I think
that,
like,
all right, here's the problem. If you have Fareed and Nurkic, Nate, you have a very high possibility of either a defensive mistake or a foul. Because bear in mind, Nurkic fouls at a crazy rate. And that was a big reason that Brian Shaw kept him off in the fourth quarter, was because he was like, I can't afford a foul in those situations. Now, you could say, like, well, this is a development season. Yeah, but, like, I don't think him fouling is going to really teach him a whole lot. Like, don't foul. So if Fareed makes a defensive jump, then you play Fareed and Nurkic, and you count on Fareed's improved defense to kind of cover, and Nurkic's size, he can also make a play. And that's pretty easy. Like, you put a shooter with Moutier, Gallo is a primary scorer, and then Fareed's energy and rebounding and defense along with Nurkic's raw size. I think it'll probably end up being Wilson, Gallo. Honestly, probably Fareed. I think it'll probably be Fareed. Nurkic is a real, like, the foul problem is real. That's an issue. He's still young and still sloppy with a lot of what he does.
Yeah, he reaches in all the time. Like, he has a great steal rate, but he has a great foul rate, too.
That's a problem.
You know?
So I don't necessarily feel comfortable putting Nurkic in those fourth quarter situations yet. You know, like, you look at Dwayne Casey and Jonas Valanciunas, right? Like, and Valanciunas' fourth quarter defensive numbers. I would be tempted. My answer here is always, like, match up to whatever the personnel is, right? Like, match up to whatever the other team's doing, because you don't necessarily have guys. Like, the only two guys that you have to have on the floor are Moutier for his development and Gallo because he gives you the best chance to win. Chandler's not a bad option, but there's also, it's like, well, okay, if you put in Chandler, then you could sacrifice rebounding. Like, it gets complicated. I don't think that there's a perfect answer here. I think that, you know, when you talk about Darrell Arthur, my thing is, I'm like, I know Darrell Arthur's going to help them get a stop. Like, he will cover defensively for whatever else. And I'm not worried about necessarily, like, I'm not worried about Darrell Arthur's man completely abandoning him to go cover Gallo. Like, I'm just not worried about that.
This is the other problem with Arthur, though, is that not only, I mean, we said he can't score. How much does that hurt you? But he jacks long twos whenever he gets the chance as well, you know? So he is not shy in addition to being ineffective.
I think if he's in that range where, again, he's been very good, kind of, he had when he was healthy, he has that shot. I'm sorry, like, Darrell Arthur is not, like, I would feel much better with a Darrell Arthur mid-range jumper than with a Kenneth Fareed mid-range jumper. Let me put it that way.
Oh. Yeah, although Fareed is maybe more likely to be open, but yeah, I mean, Arthur's a good shooter. Like, I don't think he's a bad player by any means.
What does him being on the floor do for you? And my thing is, I'm like, If you have Nurkic, you have to pair him. I almost feel like you have to pair him with an experienced guy that's not going to make a mistake. So maybe the answer is Gallo and Chandler, because that puts you in a situation where Chandler is less likely to make a mistake and can give you more, and he's an offensive threat. So that,
yeah, and if you're switching, it doesn't matter as much, right? What your execution of the scheme is. That's a very simple scheme to execute.
Yeah, I guess the scheme is okay. It's also just about awareness, right? Like, Fareed's going to chase the block. He's always going to chase the block. and that can lead to problems. And he gets out of control sometimes. Like trying to keep him tethered to reality is very difficult. And with Nurkic, it's about, even with Nurkic, there's times when he loses the tether in terms of where he's supposed to be and court awareness. So that's the problem. But maybe in reality, you just look at it and you say, Kenneth Faried is our second to third best player. He's got to be on the floor. Gallo's our best player. He's got to be on the floor. Wilson Chandler's a veteran that can hit a shot. He's got to be on the floor. Nurkic being the future, don't necessarily buy 100% into that.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think he certainly has a long way to go as well. And the fact that he missed basically an entire summer of development time is troubling. I think, and maybe I'm just overreacting to how good the unit looked against Golden State in a preseason game, which, you know, certainly I could be guilty of. But I think that Faried, Gallo, and Chandler, unless the other team has just some unbelievable post threat, I like. And the biggest reason for that, you talked about how the crunch time offense can get a little staid. Gallo at the four can always create a shot. I mean, I think he, if he's being guarded by the other team's four, and also they're dumb enough to put the four on him instead of Chandler, which, because he's the nominal four, a lot of teams just kind of do that. But I think he can always create a shot, and I like that. I think that, you know, a lot of times, and this is an observation that I've had just watching preseason as well, a lot of these teams want to take guys who are fours, and Gallo, you know, was a natural wing player more than some of these guys, but they want to take guys who are fours and put them at the three to get more of their best players on the court. Like the Hawks are always tempted to do that with Paul Millsap, the Jazz were before them, the Bulls, they want to put Mirotic at the three because they're feeling like we don't have enough wings. But the problem with that is those guys are effective because they are playing the four. Right. And I think that that goes into play with Gallo as well, or he can just be so much more effective there. And I think you just kind of decide, all right, is it going to be Faried or Nurkic, depending on who has it going on? You know, do we need a ton of defensive rebounding post defense, or, you know, and does Nurkic started to get it and not foul?
Yeah, I'll also, this is shocking considering this is me talking with my history of anti-European bias when it comes to basketball. Love Europe, but conceptually, by the way.
the concept
I like
of another diverse continent across 3,000 miles of ocean appeals to me. I don't know whether it exists or whether I'd want to go there. But
no, but I'll tell you this. If Nikola Jokic can make advances over the first, over the course of the season, I would not necessarily be opposed to keeping Faried off the floor entirely and playing Jokic at the five with Gallo Chandler. Like, that to me makes a lot of sense.
He's a good enough NBA offensive player now, I think. I mean, he doesn't have the quickest release, but really feathery touch from outside. I mean, another one of these awesome European statistical translation guys, and I can't remember too many of those guys, really, who have failed so far. You know, Capella is a guy like that. Nurkic was a guy like that who has looked good so far. So in recent vintage, I can't remember too many of those guys, especially big guys, who have looked, you know, haven't lived up to their status. And I think, you know, I kind of underrated Jokic and Capella based on their hoop zone performance, and I probably shouldn't have done that and maybe given them a little more credit, because Jokic, I think, was drafted like number 40, and he's definitely an NBA player. What do you think about LaVerne? Where does he fit in?
He's been impressing people. I've been really skeptical of him, but he's finishing stronger than I expected in NBA play, because I thought he was actually, like, everyone was really impressed with him in Eurobasket. Like, Michael Malone actually said specifically that he thought that he was finishing really strong in Eurobasket. And when I was watching, I was very much like, God, LaVerne's just not, like, he's not going nearly aggressive enough to the rim in these games for France. Like, ugh, like, just so soft. Come on. But he's been finishing a lot stronger in preseason play. He's been very good. You know, he's versatile in a lot of what he can do. I don't like him at the five. He gets just bodied out of existence by a lot of the bigger guys. I know we're going towards small ball, but not everybody is going to play fives that are Draymond Green. Like, there still are bigs in this league that you're going to have to deal with. I think as a backup four, he can do a lot for them. And I think that his offensive game is a little more, it's further along than some of the other guys that they have. I would actually say it's probably even further along in terms of, like, Faried. Like, he's got a little bit more that he can do. And,
yeah, he can hit threes.
Yeah, and he's shown good motor. So I think he's going to play a lot. I think that's the thing is with the number of guys that they have, you know, Nurkic, when everybody's healthy, Nurkic, Jokic, LaVerne, it just be crazy. LaVerne, Hixon, Darrell, Arthur, Fareed. That, you know, that's six guys that they theoretically need to get minutes for.
Yeah, and you're trying to play Gallo at the four, too.
Right, and you're trying to play Gallo at the four. That's why there's a lot of talk about Darrell Arthur slipping out of the rotation. I'm kind of like, why don't we give Darrell Arthur all of J.J. Hickson's minutes?
Well, yeah. If Hixon plays,
he's going to,
even,
though.
Like,
I don't know why.
That's ridiculous. I mean,
he has some sort of – I tell you this, man. He has some sort of telepathic ability with coaches. Like, he has a Jedi mind trick to get on the floor. And I say this as a guy that I was really impressed with J.J. Hickson's effort last year. I thought that of everybody on that disastrous Nuggets team, Hixon was the one guy that consistently gave effort, came to play as a professional, and actually tried a lot harder on defense than I've ever seen him try. Like, if he actually gives that kind of an effort, he's passable and can contribute to your team. He got better last year. Not good, but better. But for some reason, the rebounds and points, they just – The raw production, the coaches really like it. We'll see if that changes. Michael Malone may just be like, if you don't play defense, you're not going to play on this team. But, you know, I still feel like he's going to get – like, I'm still very concerned he's going to start on opening night if Nurkic is still out. I'm still concerned about that despite the – I wrote an entire thing. Fareed and Hixon cannot play together. It absolutely 100%.
Yeah, that's just been – that was like the bane of my existence, those lineups that Shaw would trot out with those two guys.
They can, and this is, that was one of the, like, the weird moments in the media thing is I finally got to the point where I was like, your defense – your starting unit is giving up 111 points per 100 possessions. You need defense on the front line. Like, you know, have you thought about putting Darrell Arthur into the lineup? And my implication was put Darrell Arthur in for J.J. Hixon. But instead, like, Shaw went nuts basically saying – I can't take out Kenneth Fareed. They'll run me out of here with pitchforks. Basically saying I would bench Fareed if I could, but he's too popular. And that was like another like big thing. That it was just like a total disaster. But yeah, so like Fareed and Hixon cannot be on the court at the same time. If you don't like how Laverne's practicing, or if he's not playing well, or you don't like the matchup, then yeah, like I'm okay with Hixon taking some of the minutes for Fareed. Hixon is an NBA player. I'm okay with that. You just cannot play those two at 4 and 5. It's such a disaster.
Yeah, I think Hixon should be totally out of the rotation, especially when you consider that this is ostensibly a rebuilding year,
right.
a building year.
A big reason they brought back Darrell Arthur is to help this team help teach defensive principles to these young guys so that they understand how to communicate, to provide the kind of stuff that he knows how to do. There's not a whole lot of reason. Like, I don't know what J.J. Hickson's going to teach this team. So him being a trade candidate, I think, is definitely possible.
So what do you see as the main strengths of this team that they're going to be able to rely on that other teams are going to be fearing on a night-to-night basis?
I think they're going to wear you out. I think that the effort level is going to be very high. I think they're going to come to play. I think they're going to get back to being the team that when you play the Nuggets, you just dread it because you're like, God, they're just going to drag me up and down the court for 48 minutes. The pace is a question, but I think even if the pace isn't necessarily as fast as some might want it, or if it's not Nuggets basketball or it's not George Karl pace, there will still be a purpose in what they do. They're going to get up and they're going to go at you, and they're not going to think about it too much, and that's exhausting. I think Kenneth Fareed is going to have a real breakout year, and he's going to be real problematic. I think Danilo Gallinari is going to have a strong season. I think they're going to surprise teams with how they execute in terms of they're going to put themselves in a good position to score, even if they're not able to because of the talent and the shooters that are available. And defensively, I think that they're going to be tough. And I think that brings, you know, that again is something that they're not going to be a pushover, a team that you just blow by. They're going to be, I think, a tough defensive team. They are going to be sloppy and they're going to make mistakes, but at least they're going to hit you at various points in the game.
Yeah. And this is a team that, to me, they don't have any really obvious strengths,
right.
I mean, you would think that Gallo is kind of their best one-on-one player. Maybe you're going to be trying to prepare for him. You know, the shooting is like okay, good enough, depending on who they're playing, but not like unbelievable. I mean, I think if they go with Nurkic and Fareed, the offensive rebounding is something that could give some teams problems.
Yeah.
But what about from a weaknesses standpoint? you know, I think there is the youth aspect, but other than kind of the mistakes of youth, I don't see a glaring weakness on this squad either.
Defense is going to be a weakness. I think Malone's going to make them better in how they approach it, but there are too many guys on this team that you cannot point to and say, I feel confident that he is going to stay tethered to what they need to do. They're going to be able to maintain space. Like they have real awareness issues. Like they just have low awareness problems. And that's going to be, that's one of the reasons they fouled so much, is they were out of position a lot. I think that that's, you know, if Malone can fix that, their defense will come a long way. I can't trust in that yet. Right. Like I just can't, you're going to have to prove that to me. Shooting is another one where you're going to have to prove it to me. Cause like I did a whole thing on Jameer Nelson, a big feature on him. And I think that what he's going to bring to this team for leadership is going to be great. You know, Jameer's older. He's not a knockdown shooter anymore. Gary Harris, you can't until as much as I'm talking about how he's going to win the two spot, until he proves that he actually is going to be held those in games, I can't believe he's going to hit those in games. Like he's got to show.
Yeah, I guess if they start Moutier, Harris, and Fareed, that's three question marks from a shooting perspective.
So, you know.
And the center's not going to be able to shoot threes either.
Gallo can't shoot 95 times a game. Like that's not something that they can do, right? And Wilson really struggled last year in spot up shots. That was a huge problem for him. He was one of the, like he's been traditionally a very good spot up shooter and he was atrocious last year. He again is a guy that's going to have to prove to me that he can knock down those spot up shots and those kind of opportunities. You know, until Nurkic gets back, they don't have any post scoring. Like I don't look at anybody outside of Jokic and say that guy can score in the post. The league's advanced. You don't really need that, but it's still a weakness. They don't have that dynamic. So I think their spacing will be better, but I think their shooting will be bad. So, you know, they're still going to struggle to shoot and struggle to defend, which is why it's kind of crazy is that I'm as high on them as I am.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's see how high you are. What's your predicted record?
All right. Look.
All right, maybe that's not a good question to ask for someone who lives in Denver, but well, no, let's see how high on the Nuggets you are.
I talked a lot about this. I have them for a crazy amount of wins, and I recognize that they're a crazy amount of wins. I could have split the difference when I'm doing my win totals and kind of just plugged away and had everybody kind of the same range, and it maybe would have been more accurate. I would rather hit on one, because I've done this enough years in a row, where like I would rather hit than be like reasonably close but not really accurate on any of these teams. Right?
Yeah, because you can obviously crow about the ones you did well on and just not mention the ones that you didn't do well on.
I typically don't mention the ones I do terribly on. I tend to, you know, like last year I was like, totally missed on Milwaukee, my bad. Well,
everyone did on that.
And like, not James Herbert, surprisingly. Like in the Eastern Conference, where I feel like Pistons, Knicks, Hornets, Pacers, Nets are all in that range. And it's like, you got to pick one of them to win the Hunger Games. Like one of them is going to come out and you just kind of go with whoever it is that you feel like has the best combination. I'm in a similar spot with, not to make the playoffs, but Nuggets, Kings, Lakers. I think who else is in that range?
Suns.
I think the Suns are probably a little bit higher. I think they're in a tier with the Jazz in their own tier.
Portland,
the 8 seed. I think Portland's gonna be the worst team in the league.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm probably gonna be wrong on that. All the projections have them way higher. I think I'm gonna look really dumb in a couple months, but I just can't get past it. So anyway, you have those kind of teams, and it's like somebody's gonna do it. And my thing is, I'm like, look, I don't know if George Karl and Cousins are gonna be able to figure this out. I don't know if George Karl and Rondo are gonna get along. Forget the comments that Rondo had yesterday that he was joking. Just the fact that I know George Karl and he goes ballistic when his guards do not take the layup when they have it in transition, and Rondo is a critical abuser of that privilege, like always shopping for the assist, right, because he doesn't want to get fouled. I have real questions about how if that team's going to be able to sustain or if they're going to blow up. So I can't take them. Can't take the Lakers, right, because of a number of things I'm sure you talked about with Darius.
Yeah.
I have the Nuggets at 40 wins, which I believe is their absolute 100% ceiling. I have them hitting their ceiling. I think there's I know.
So
I think their floor is pitiful.
Well, all right. So how do they get there? I mean, 40 wins, that's basically an average team. So you kind of got to add up to, you know, your average, your offensive and defensive efficiency. You're at about 15th, where do you see the offense? Where do you see the defense to get you to that point?
Gallo has a big year. The pace improvements get them back into range of just ups the offensive efficiency. Fareed making plays, the offensive rebounding gets you some of the way there. Wilson Chandler has a bounce back year. Emmanuel Mudiay's passing sets up for guys for high percentage, low contest opportunities on things like back cuts and things like that. And they're basic. And a lot of this is just they're a team with good chemistry. We've seen this with teams that play with a good vibe. As much as the individual dynamics matter, there are years where the cumulative vibe of the team improves them consistently, and I think that this team is in line for that. Defensively, I'm banking a lot on, I think that Michael Malone's going to get the best out of Kenneth Fareed, and if that happens, things change for them. Things change in a hurry for them defensively. He fills a major hole in what they need by being able to provide them with a guy that's going to make plays in terms of block shots and running and getting dunks and putbacks and all that stuff. And if he's able to give them defensive plays where he actually just deters solid defense, that changes a lot of it, and I think that they combine that with the size and the kind of intelligence that they have with some of their veteran players. I like them to at least increase, and then you factor in, I think they're going to be much better at home, which has always been a huge thing for them. They face fewer teams on back-to-backs in Pepsi Center than they have in, I think, as far back as 6 years. I look back 6 years. This is the fewest they've played. They play teams on a back-to-back, but I still think that they're going to run them out, and they're going to get back to that being a home court advantage, and I think that boosts them up a little bit. This also was made without – I made a critical mistake when I did this. I'm sticking to it because I'm kind of like I wanted to make this prediction. But their November schedule is a nightmare. They are going to be in a hole early. But I think
– Well, and that could have a negative effect on their wins, right, too, because you can see them trying to kind of play more young guys. And you know, it's guys like Jokic or LaVerne, I think they want to get a look at who maybe kind of aren't ready – defensively. But do you think go ahead.
I don't think they'll tank. I really don't, because I think
they do have the swap.
They
with
have the
Knicks,
swap,
right?
And just with where this team is at, they are like, they're not looking to be like they would have. Oh, yeah, I guess here's the thing: if Gallo gets hurt and they bottom out and they're like they're one of the bottom four teams in the league, then that they'll probably start tanking, because it's just the only thing that you can really justify doing because everything has gone wrong. But if they're 6, 7, 8, which is where they've been the last couple of years, I think that they actually try and win some games to finish out the year to build momentum towards next year.
Yeah, that's definitely something that could happen as far as like what their mindset is. And Kevin Pelton wrote in his preview that they actually are projected to have about as high of odds of the number one pick as Philly, because they have that pick swap between them and the Knicks, and that gives them kind of more lottery balls to get in to the top three. So do you kind of see, I mean, it sounds like you're not that high on the defense. You expect the defense to be a little below average. Are you kind of thinking the way they get to being an average team is, you know, like 10th in offense, 20th in defense? Is that sort of like how you're putting that all together?
Yeah, that they're able to head in that direction. I also think a lot of it is, I think they'll be better by the end of the year than when they begin. And that's not true for a lot of teams. Like, I think, you know, it's easy to say that about every team at the beginning of the year, but this is one that I actually do think that Malone's coaching, because Malone's not going to wear them out. Malone's not going to drag them down. Malone's going to stay with them, and Malone's going to be like, look, we're not trying to make the playoffs. We're trying to get better. We want to build something here. You know, like, we want to win games. We're all competitors. But I think that his ability to connect with the players, and I think that'll help them in terms of, when they got into losing streaks, it just came apart. They would just get blown apart for weeks at a time last year. I think because they would go on a win streak early and then just completely detonate. And I think they'll change this year, where each game is like an individual situation, and they won't be as caught up in trying to maintain or reverse momentum. And I think that consistency will do very well for them over the course of the year. And I think that by the end of the year, Nurkic will be a better defensive player. Fareed will be a better defensive player. Jokic, LaVerne, all these young guys, I think they'll be better defensive players, and that will help them a lot in terms of sneaking out wins.
Yeah, I don't see them quite that high. I probably have them in like high 20s, which I think is still – what is their over-under, like 26
yeah,
or something
pitiful.
Like that?
It's something pitiful. Look, I don't have any problem with anybody saying this is going to be a sub-30 win team. Like, I don't have any – I'm not like, no, you're all wrong. I'm like, no. Like, I see a formula here and the beginning of something that I'm willing to buy into more than I am the other teams. But they play in the Western Conference. They don't have a superstar. They're starting a bunch of young guys. Picking them for sub-30 wins is a very reasonable and probably smarter proposition. I decided this is a gamble I wanted to take.
Yeah, I understand that viewpoint. And you, of course, are fitting in with everyone else who's come on. Everybody who is, and I think we're probably at like 20 of these now.
Talking about this. Yeah.
Everyone is over except for one person, and that was Jeremy Schmidt from Bucksketball is the only one who went under their over-under this
year. Yeah, and I guess I want to talk about that. So I find that whole dynamic interesting, and Ethan's talked a lot about this, sure, with Strauss. He's talked a lot about, you know, are you a homer, or do you have – I think that there's definitely an element of too close to the trees to see the forest. I think that there's definitely an element there. With me, it's weird because I realized I was like, I'm taking the Nuggets under 3 years in a row. I very almost was like, you know, I'm picking them for 20 just to be safe here. Like, I'm not going to be that guy because I don't want to be that guy, right? Like, I don't have any connection to the Nuggets. I'm not emotionally invested in them. Like, I hope that they're interesting so that I can cover them, but that's it. I think that there is a matter of, with my specific situation, when you see change, it's very easy to buy into the new regime. Like, it's like, well, it's not what it was before. So, it's got to be better, right? And so it's very easy to buy into change and before you see it. If they brought Shaw back, good Lord, I would have had them for 15 wins. Like, it would have been absolutely atrocious, even if they had Moutier. Like, it would just be absolutely rock bottom. I'm buying into the vibe, and that's, like, a very non-concrete, non-empirical approach. But I do think that there are times when that trumps the metrics. I think the good teams, those metrics trump them, which is why they're not going to win over 40 games. I do find the dynamic interesting, though, that you're talking about, where everyone kind of believes, because it's not like you're interviewing a bunch of fans, right? Like,
I don't think in any of those cases it's a matter of, oh, I'm a fan of this team. I just can't see the forest for the trees. I'm, you know, swept up in the emotions of it all. I think it's just when you're around the team, just generally teams are more optimistic during training camp. But the biggest thing to me is just underrating the effect of potential injuries. I think that's when you just kind of lose it. And on a lot of these over-unders, you know, if all of these teams are healthy, I think it's totally reasonable to have – to think, all right, you know, if this team stays healthy, they're three or four wins better, and then trying to predict which of the teams are going to get injured is kind of a difficult task. And so it's a lot easier sort of to say that that's going to happen to the other teams than it is to the team that you're covering. So I think, and that's what I ascribe it to, but, you know, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe they'll all go over, and I'll look like an idiot.
So I have an interesting addition to this. I ran an over-unders piece on CBSSports.com yesterday. And
oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite ones on a yearly basis.
And part of what I'm featuring is data from our new analytics picks and gambling and fantasy site Sportsline.com, which is all data-driven. And I spoke to Stephen O., who runs the program over there. He's the head of analytics and the head of Sportsline. And one of the things – he sent me over their projections – and one of the things he said was, we have unders for a lot of the big-name Western Conference teams. They're under on the Clippers, Rockets, and Grizzlies. And he said what happens is that the odds makers know that injuries will end up taking their toll on four or five teams each year, and these teams will lose more games than they would have if healthy. The good teams then get the three or five more wins thanks to injuries wiping out some teams. But in the Sportsline Sims, we only account for known injuries. So some of these over-unders are factored with the idea of, you know, like, that basically the stronger teams are going to victimize the weaker ones because somebody's going to get hurt and they're going to drop, you know? So, like, I mean, Dallas, I think, is the one that we kind of see coming. It's always the ones you don't see coming that's a problem, but Dallas is the one you can see coming, right? Like, if those guys are not able to get back, like if Wes has complications from the Achilles or if Chandler's knee gives him another problem or Darren's ankle or if all three of those, like Dallas is going to be absolutely rock bottom, atrocious. And if that happens, those wins have to go somewhere. And that's a place where teams like the Lakers and the Nuggets and the Kings can pick up victories where they might typically split with the Mavericks 2-2 or 2-1, or lose 2-1, and those injuries happen, like those go to them then. And that's really why these over-unders are always so complicated, because it's also, it's not just who you play, it's when. And that's a really big thing. Like, the Pelicans have the Warriors twice in the early season, but they're going to be without Steve Kerr. And that's probably not going to matter. I would still pick I'm going to pick the Warriors in both of those games. But that's the kind of situation where if that ends up mattering and Kerr's still out, you know, that's a place where the Pelicans have just picked up 2 wins versus the best team in the league. So these dynamics on these over-unders is always crazy, because what we're basically trying to do is we're trying to figure out how good are they going to be. And sometimes that really doesn't impact into whether or not they're going to hit their over-under. Now, that obviously does with me, because I'm picking them like 14 games over their over-under. But that's just one of the...
It's not that much, really.
I think that's interesting when we look at it.
All right, last question for you. What is your grade for, I guess we'll say, the Tim Connelly regime? So he came in end of 2013 when Ujiri moved to Toronto. What is your grade for them, ownership, you know, the whole management team since that time?
Oh.
I mean, we can kind of run through the moves, and maybe that'll
set
the table for us.
I can give it to you. I'm just trying to get, I know the range. I'm just trying to figure out which side of the C I come up out on. I'll give him a C-. Drafting Tim Connelly is a genius. He's been fantastic. He's just been really good. He passed over Rudy Gobert fine. I don't think most people...
Yeah, they did trade away Rudy Gobert for cash. That was not good.
No, but nobody... I'm sorry. I didn't see Rudy Gobert. Neither did most of the people I heard from think Rudy Gobert was going to be Rudy Gobert. So, like, if you did, props to you, Nate. You're a smart dude. But I just can't... I can't...
Yeah. Well, I've missed on plenty, right, too, so it's not... And you certainly acknowledge that when a guy is in that low of a range, nobody's a sure thing. So I acknowledge that. But they are also, I think, the last team to ever sell. They might be the last team that ever sells a first-round pick.
Don't count out Robert Sarver. Don't ever count out Bob.
Yeah, but I think even he realizes now that keeping a first-round pick is the best way to actually be cheap.
Right. So I think... He drafted Nurkic, drafted Moutier, drafted Harris. Those are three, in my opinion, wins. I think they've done well with their second-round picks. I think they've accumulated a lot of talent.
And don't forget the trade of 11 for 16 and 19. That was pretty good.
Right. They didn't do – you can argue like they didn't have the ability to because they were too bad this summer. But they didn't do anything stupid with cap space this summer. They didn't clear out Ty and then go chasing after somebody that wasn't that good and wasn't going to help them. Like they haven't made that kind of decision.
Yeah. I thought the way they used their cap space was fantastic, right, with the renegotiation of Gallo and Wilson Chandler.
They picked up all those picks for Aflalo and Mozgov last year, but you have to factor in one of those went back out in the JaVale trade, and one of them, and like they're all super protected. They have like the possibility of a lot of good picks, but they don't actually have a lot of good picks. So some of that's a little bit of noise. Free agency really wasn't like they signed Nate Robinson and JJ Hickson, and those were two really, to me, those were huge problems. Connelly didn't have, like, that wasn't really a Brian Shaw. That wasn't really Connelly.
It's not only Connelly. I'm throwing it all together as ownership, management. I mean, just the overall performance.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
then I'm probably getting, if we're talking about Josh Kroenke and the brain trust, I'm probably talking D plus.
Because that's what it, I mean, whether it's the GM or not, whether it's his fault or not, I mean, I think it's more realistic to just do the ownership and management, because that's the end product. That's what makes the end product.
They're very touchy about this. They get very defensive, but like there's a lot of noise in terms of who's, that kitchen is awfully crowded is what I would say. There's a lot of cooks in that kitchen. So, it's a real complicated situation in terms of how everyone's role and what happens. But at the end of the day, it's Josh Kroenke and Tim Connelly is running the draft. And Tim Connelly's run the draft really well. They obviously missed on Brian Shaw. You know, Michael Malone, it's hard for me to, even if he winds up wiping out, it's going to be hard for me to really blame him, because Michael Malone's a guy who everyone, like, I've yet to hear anybody in the league say a negative thing about. Everyone loves him, you know, from LeBron to other coaches to everyone. Everyone's dealt with Michael Malone loves him. So it's going to be hard for me to blame him for that. But right now I'd have to give him a D+ for how, especially, I guess here's the big thing. They let Masai Ujiri walk. And that to me was borderline unforgivable. It was just atrocious. Like George
Karl. I mean, they just didn't want to pay him enough.
Yeah.
Right?
George Karl is a stubborn dude. You can talk about it in terms of like, well, it was ridiculous what Toronto offered him. Yeah, because Masai Ujiri is really good. And you can look at what happens with Toronto and see that. Like, there's a reason that Toronto.
Well, and GMs should just make more anyway.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's been the thing with the Nuggets, is they don't believe that coaches or management is worth the investment. And that to me is like, it's a very backward-ass way of approaching the league, with how important overall management of various structures, from training staffs to analytics to everything. The good organizations have smart people that are well-paid in positions to succeed, and the bad organizations do kind of the opposite, with the exception of Philly, which is a whole other thing. So it's like, you know, you need to invest in your people, and they tend to believe that if they're investing in their players, that that's enough, and they kind of need to change that mindset. But we'll see. You know, maybe everything works out and then Tim Connelly looks like a genius. But for right now, yeah, I'd have to give him a D+ factoring everything.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe you could even throw in letting Karl go into that as well. They weren't able to retain Iguodala. Maybe if they had offered him more money, they could have retained him. I guess, you know, ultimately when a team goes from 57 wins to basically totally rebuilding, you know, that's not great.
The thing, though, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, maxing him out, I mean, at the time, maybe wouldn't have worked too good. Now, with the cap going up, it doesn't look as terrible when you consider what
kind
of
the
market is.
Yeah, I don't think it was an option. Everyone acts like this is like, I mean, he sold out the team to the Warriors. Like, I don't know you're coming. And also, having talked to him consistently throughout that year, I don't believe that he was traded to Denver. That was never his choice. And Iguodala Andre Iguodala is a really smart dude and has a great career, obviously finals MVP. And I enjoyed talking to him when I did, but he had plans. Like, he's a tech dude. He wanted to be in the environment that Golden State provides him. I don't think that there, and he was also really close. He got to be buds with Curry and Thompson during Team USA, and he was also 100% on Mark Jackson's whole religious thing. Like, everyone kind of looks at it like, they let Iguodala go, and I'm like, I don't think there was ever I don't think that they had any chance of getting him back, the more I've looked at it in retrospect. So.
Yeah, all right. Well, you would definitely know better about that than I do, so perhaps that's not a fair criticism in that case. I'm trying to think of what my grade would be, because, you know, I mean, whenever the Shaw hire was obviously a disaster, but I mean, I think that they have rebounded relatively well. They've drafted relatively well. The Hickson signing was pretty bad. Letting Kostakoufos. Oh, actually, you know what they should get a ton of credit for is signing Mozgov to that $5 million deal, which everyone was ridiculing. They're like, I can't. And I was too at the time. I was like, I can't believe you signed Mozgov and you let Kostakoufos go. Mozgov is now considered a better player than Kufos, and because he was on such a cheap contract, they were basically able to trade him for 2 first-round picks. So that actually was quite a coup, despite being panned at the time. That's something that should be considered. So yeah, I think I would go C+. I think that the first kind of 2-3 months was pretty rough, other than the Mozgov signing. But since then, they haven't done a ton. That, and obviously signing Shaw wasn't any good, but since then I can't think of anything they've done that I thought was really bad.
Yeah.
And selling the Gobert pick obviously occurred right in that early period as well.
The Hickson and Robinson signings were, especially in the context in which they were done, was not optimal. So, but yeah, I think it's like, I think, well, you also have to factor in that they tried to give Kenneth Faried a deal in which they could not. Like, that has to factor into the conversation.
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on that, and I think also now that they have Pete D'Alessandro in the mix, that'll help them with that kind of stuff, because he's a pretty good cap guy. You know, I'm sure that kind of stuff happens all the time.
We just don't hear about it.
It's just, for people who forget what it was, it was reported that Faried was going to be signing an extension for 5 for $60 million. But you can only sign a 5-year deal if you're the designated player and you get maxed out in a rookie extension. So they ended up having to just do 4 for 48 instead. Didn't really hurt them at all, just was kind of embarrassing. And I'm sure teams make those kind of mistakes all the time. It just happened to be that everyone wanted to crow that he was going to sign this contract, and then, oh, wait, he can't do it. You know, so it came out. I don't downgrade them that much for that aspect. And ultimately, I mean, can you think of any other bad moves like that actually were consummated since sort of that initial period that we should be down on?
No, but you're also looking at it from that perspective, right? Like, well, what have they done that was that bad? You also have to factor in what did they not do that was problematic, and they bungled the Ty Lawson situation from start to finish.
They should have moved him. But, you know, on the other hand, they didn't know that they were going to get Emmanuel Mudiay in the draft.
Yeah, but you knew you were going to get him on draft night, and this is like a really complicated thing, because basically this comes down to, and this is like a philosophical thing. Most GMs will tell you, I can only do the deals that are available. Like, I can't magically make a deal appear. And there's a lot of writers that feel that way too, right? That when they talk to them, like, that makes sense. Like, you can't do it. My thing is, I'm always like, your job is to be inventive and creative and to find the deals that you need to make. And they needed to get Ty somewhere else. They also needed to get him help, but that I think they tried, and that I can't blame them for, but they needed to move Ty on draft night. It needed to happen, and they were unable to find the deal. And you can say it just wasn't there. I think you have to find it, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I think this year was hard too, because a lot of teams had kind of free agent plans, and any deal that would have been made would have been trading him, I think, into cap space most likely. So, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think we're getting too far afield for this podcast with so many permutations that there could be. When we get you out of here, that over-under column, obviously I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I want to leave that. What else you got to plug?
If you get a chance, check out my Jameer Nelson. Just Google Matt Moore, CBS Sports, Jameer Nelson. I did a big feature on him that I'm really proud of. He did a podcast with us. That was really fun. And just talked about veteran leadership and kind of the impact of that. I've got a Dwight Howard thing coming out on Sunday, talking about how it's probably time for the narrative around Dwight to change. And yeah, we'll have lots of stuff. Also, make sure to check out the HP Preview magazine that came out today on hardwoodparoxysm.com. That was put together by my staff, particularly Ian Levy, who's editor-in-chief of Hardwood Paroxysm. It's chock full of cool art and stats and charts and in-depth player profiles and weird stuff. Like, it's just a really cool feature that we put out every year, and I know the staff's really proud of it, so be sure to check that out.
Yeah, and if you're a dork and you like Nylon Calculus the way I do, they have a little bit for each of the team previews as well from a stats perspective, so that'll be something I'm looking forward to reading as well. All right, well, thanks so much to Matt for coming on. You can follow him at HP Basketball on Twitter as well. Excellent Twitter account. And he even retweets some of my stuff, which makes it more excellent. And as for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. You can follow most of my work, written or podcast form, at my Facebook page, also NateDuncanNBA. If you want to support the podcast, the cap space code, all one word, on SeatGeek or DraftKings is a great way to do that. And thank you so much for listening. We got some more great previews coming up. And our previous ones, we did the Lakers last night with Darius Soriano. That was an excellent one. Bucks and Sixers for two kind of up-and-coming teams was really good, that came out recently as well. And the Knicks with Jason Concepcion and Jared Dubin is also a fantastic listen. So thanks again for the support. We really appreciate it, and we will talk to you all next time.